Welcome to Base by Base, the podcast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So today we're tackling a really tough issue that casts a shadow over a lot of successful cancer treatments. It's chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, or CIN.
Right.
I mean, think about it. You have these incredibly powerful cancer drugs, right? They're designed very specifically to hunt down and kill cancer cells, often by messing with their DNA.
Which is what you need them to do. It's like targeted cellular warfare. But there's often this tragic side effect. That same DNA targeting power can accidentally hit healthy nerve cells.
And it kills them. It's not just, you know, a minor inconvenience. The numbers are pretty staggering. We're seeing figures like 30% to almost 70% of cancer survivors dealing with chronic CIN.
Yeah, that 68% figure is sobering. And they're living with pain, numbness, maybe problems with movement long after the cancer itself is gone.
And for certain drugs, it's even worse.
Oh, absolutely. With drugs like oxaliplatin, you might see up to 90% of patients affected. 90%. That's a huge impact on someone's life,
yeah,
caused by the very treatment that saved them.
So the central mystery really has been, what's the molecular switch? What exactly tells a healthy nerve cell, okay, time to self-destruct during chemo? It's been kind of murky.
Uh-huh. Until now, maybe?
Exactly. We're looking at a study today that points to a pretty surprising culprit. It connects how cells sense damaged DNA directly to how nerve fibers die off.
And this really could change how we approach preventing this kind of nerve damage.
Yep.
It opens up some potentially new therapeutic doors.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty, we absolutely have to give credit where it's due. We want to celebrate the fantastic work from the research team led by Lina Wang, Kuailing Lu, Cheng Li Song, and Qingkai Yang.
Yes, great work. Mostly coming out of Dalian Medical University and Sun Yat-sen University Cancer Center. They've really advanced our understanding here.
What they did was take a protein, SARM1, which we kind of thought we knew, and revealed this whole new function for it acting as a DNA sensor in nerve damage.
It's a fundamental shift in its known roles.
Okay, let's set the stage a bit. The underlying biology here revolves around something called DNA sensing. It's like a basic defense strategy for life, right?
Absolutely critical. Cells need to spot DNA that doesn't belong maybe from a virus, that's non-self DNA, or DNA that's damaged and in the wrong place, like floating in the cytoplasm. That's abnormal self DNA.
It's like the cell's alarm system. If DNA shows up where it shouldn't, alarm should go off.
Exactly. But which proteins sound the alarm and how they react? That's still being figured out in many cases. And that lack of detail has made it tough to, you know, develop treatments for problems like CIN that seem linked to this.
Enter the star of today's story. SARM1. That stands for sterol alpha and tall interleukin-1 receptor motif containing 1. Quite a mouthful.
Huh, yeah. But if you're in neurobiology, SARM1 is already a big deal.
It is. It's kind of infamous, actually, as the main executioner protein when axons degenerate.
Right, when those long nerve fibers, the axons, start to break down and die back, SARM1 is the trigger man.
And its weapon of choice is pretty brutal. It has this unique enzymatic activity. It's an NADase. It's the only one like it in mammals, as far as we know.
Which means when SARM1 gets activated, it just starts shredding,
yeah,
NAD plus nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide.
And NAD plus isn't just some minor molecule. It's absolutely essential for, well, everything. Energy, metabolism, DNA repair.
It's non-negotiable for cell survival. So if SARM1 starts chewing it up rapidly, the cell is doomed. It's a death sentence.
Now, we already knew one way to flip SARM1's on switch. Certain molecules like NMN nicotinamide mononucleotide can bind to a specific part of SARM1, the arm domain.
Right. NMN competes with NAD plus for that arm binding site. And when NMN wins, SARM1 gets activated. That was the known pathway.
But this study, it throws a massive wrench into that simple picture.
Yeah. It reveals a completely different way to turn SARM1 on. Another trigger entirely.
Okay. Let's dig into how they found this. The methodology. How did they even suspect SARM1 might be listening for DNA?
It actually started with a broad screen. They were testing a bunch of different cellular molecules to see what might boost the production of something called KDPR.
Ah, KDPR. That's the leftover stuff when SARM1 chews up a NAD plus A, right? Like its metabolic fingerprint.
Exactly. It tells you SARM1 has been active. And guess what lit up the screen?
Let me guess. Double-stranded DNA.
Bingo. Adding dsDNA made KDPR levels shoot way up. That was the first big clue SARM-1 was firing in the presence of DNA.
Okay, so that suggests the link, but it doesn't prove they're physically interacting. How did they confirm that?
They brought out the biophysical toolkit, techniques like MSA, MST, MARTIF-Q, basically sophisticated ways to watch molecules stick together in real time.
Like tiny molecular cameras watching the handshake.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And all these different methods confirmed it. SARM-1 physically binds directly to dsDNA, no question.
But the really critical part, I think, was figuring out where on SARM-1 this binding happens.
Absolutely fundamental, because SARM-1 isn't just one big blob. It has distinct sections or domains.
The ARM, SAM, and TR domains.
Right. So they tested pieces of the protein, and they found that dsDNA binds specifically to the TR domain.
The TR domain, that's huge, because the NAD plus and NMN binding site we knew about is way over on their ARM domain.
Exactly. It means there are two separate control panels. NMN uses the front door, the ARM domain, to activate SARM-1. But now we know dsDNA uses this newly found back door, the TR domain.
Two distinct ways to turn on the executioner protein. That has really big implications, which I guess we'll get to.
Oh, definitely. Especially for designing smarter drugs.
So let's get into the details of this new TR-dsDNA connection. What did they learn about how SARM-1 recognizes DNA through this back door? Are there rules?
There are. First, it's sequence independent. SARM-1 doesn't seem to care about the specific genetic code, the A's, T's, C's, and G's.
It's not reading the message, just sensing the presence of DNA itself.
Seems like it. But it's very particular about the shape and specifically the length.
Ah, okay. How long does the DNA need to be?
It needs to be about 45 base pairs or longer. If they use shorter fragments, say 20 or 30 base pairs, SARM-1 basically ignored them, didn't bind, didn't activate.
So it's looking for a certain minimum size or structure, not just any old piece of DNA.
Precisely. It suggests a specific kind of structural interaction is needed to flip the switch.
And they actually managed to visualize this structure, didn't they, using techniques like ITC and SCC?
Yeah, the structural insights are fascinating. SARM-1 itself forms this large complex, an octamer think, 8 units working together. And in the active state, when it's ready to destroy NAD plus Wes, they found that 2 dsDNA molecules get sandwiched between 2 parts of this SARM-1 structure, specifically the TR assemblies.
Wow, so the DNA isn't just docking on the side, it's becoming part of the active structure, acting like a bridge or a scaffold.
Exactly. It seems to stabilize the active destructive conformation of the SARM-1 enzyme. The DNA itself helps lock it into kill mode.
Incredible detail. Did they manage to pinpoint the exact contact points, the amino acids involved?
They did. They narrowed it down to 3 specific lysine residues, amino acids in that TR domain, K602, K628, and K636. These seem to be the key anchor points holding the DNA in place.
Lysines often interact with the negatively charged DNA backbone, so that makes sense.
Right, and to prove it, they made a mutant version of SARM-1, where they changed those 3 lysines. They called it the 3KE mutation.
And what happened with the 3KE mutant?
It completely lost the ability to bind dsDNA. And crucially, it couldn't be activated by dsDNA anymore either.
That's the clincher. That mutation proves the physical binding at those points is essential for the activation via DNA.
It's the smoking gun for this specific interaction, absolutely.
Okay, so they've established the mechanism. dsDNA binds the TR domain via these lysines, stabilizes the active SARM-1, NAD plus gets destroyed. Now, how did they connect this back to real biological situations?
First, they tested it with non-self DNA. They either added dsDNA directly to cells from the outside, or they infected cells with a virus that has a dsDNA genome, like herpes simplex virus 1.
And did SARM-1 react?
Like clockwork. In both scenarios, the presence of that foreign DNA triggered SARM-1. Their TOS levels dropped, and the cells started dying. This confirms SARM-1 acts as a sensor for invading DNA.
Okay, that covers non-self DNA, but what about the original problem, CIN, the abnormal self DNA generated by chemotherapy?
Right, the crucial link. They treated cells with those chemo drugs known to cause neuropathy, oxaloplatin, cisplatin, and others.
And what did they observe inside the cells?
They saw exactly what the mechanism predicted. The chemo caused cytosolic dsDNA to build up fragments of the cell's own DNA leaking out of the nucleus into the main body of the cell.
The abnormal self DNA.
Precisely. And importantly, this leaked DNA was found right next to SARM-1 molecules it colocalized, and then SARM-1 activation followed. NAD plus degradation and cell death.
So the chemo damages the DNA, some fragments leak out, SARM-1 senses them via its TR domain, gets activated, and kills the cell, in this case, the nerve cell.
That's the pathway they've laid out. It provides, really for the first time, a clear molecular explanation for why these specific drugs cause this nerve damage. It's the DNA fragments acting as the trigger.
That feels like the missing piece of the puzzle for CIN.
It really does seem to be.
Which brings us to, arguably, the most impactful part of the study. The validation in a living system. Does blocking this pathway actually prevent nerve damage in animals?
This is where it gets really exciting. They used mouse models of CIN. They gave mice oxaliplatin, which reliably causes neuropathy symptoms.
Things like sensitivity to touch or temperature, odd limb movements.
Exactly. Hind limb clasping, thermal hyperaldesia, mechanical allodynia, all classic signs. The nerves are damaged and hypersensitive. The chemo-treated mice developed these expected symptoms.
Okay, so the model works. Then they tested the interventions.
Yes. First, they used mice completely lacking SARM1, the SARM1 knockout mice. When these mice got chemo...
No neuropathy.
Pretty much. The CIN symptoms were essentially blind. Getting rid of SARM1 altogether protected the mice from the chemo-induced nerve damage.
Okay, that confirms SARM1 is necessary for CIN. But what about targeting just the DNA binding using their special mutation?
That was the key test. They used mice carrying the 3KE mutation, the one where SARM1 is present, but just can't grab onto DNA via the TR domain.
And the result?
Those mice were also protected. Introducing that specific DNA binding mutation significantly diminished or prevented the CIN symptoms, almost as well as removing SARM1 entirely.
Wow. So just stopping SARM1 from sensing the leaked DNA was enough to block the neuropathy in the animal model.
It strongly suggests that this DNA sensing pathway is the primary driver of CIN caused by these drugs. That is potentially game-changing for developing preventative treatments.
Let's talk about that therapeutic angle. We now know SARM1 has at least two activation switches, the ARM domain responding to NMNNAD+ levels and the TIR domain responding to dsDNA. Why target the TIR domain specifically?
It comes down to specificity and avoiding side effects. NAD+ metabolism is fundamental to, well, almost everything in the cell.
Right. Hundreds of enzymes rely on NAD+.
Exactly. So if you develop a drug that broadly messes with SARM1's interaction with NAD+ or NMN at the ARM domain, you risk hitting all sorts of other vital metabolic pathways. The potential for off-target effects is huge.
Okay, makes sense. But the TR domain interaction with dsDNA.
That seems much more specific to this pathological situation, the accumulation of DNA where it shouldn't be. So if you can design a molecule that just blocks that specific DNA binding pocket on the TR domain,
you could potentially stop SARM1 activation triggered by chemo without messing up normal NAD+ metabolism elsewhere.
That's the hope. It offers a much cleaner, more targeted approach.
Yeah.
A selective strategy to prevent CIN by blocking this specific trigger.
Thinking bigger picture now, if SARM1 senses dsDNA in a sequence-independent way, just based on length, does this have implications beyond just chemotherapy?
It certainly could. Think about other conditions where cells are under stress and might accumulate cytosolic DNA, maybe severe infections, autoimmune diseases, perhaps even just the process of aging where DNA damage can increase.
So SARM1 might be acting as a more general danger sensor for cellular damage or chaos signaled by misplaced DNA.
It's a definite possibility. This study focused on CIN, but the mechanism itself, SARM1 sensing cytosolic dsDNA, might be relevant in a much wider range of neurodegenerative or pathological states linked to DNA damage. The researchers do mention this needs more investigation, of course.
Okay, let's try to boil this down. For everyone listening, what's the core take-home message here?
All right. The central insight is that SARM1, which we knew was the main executioner protein in nerve fiber degeneration, has this newly discovered function. It gets activated by double-stranded DNA binding directly to its tie domain.
And this activation leads to SARM1 destroying NAT plus NO, the cell's vital energy currency, which ultimately kills the cell.
And critically, this specific DNA sensing mechanism appears to be the direct driver of chemotherapy-induced nerve damage, or CIN.
Which means targeting this specific TIR-DNA interaction gives us a brand new, potentially much safer strategy to prevent this devastating side effect for cancer patients.
Exactly. A highly selective molecular target.
So the final thought to leave you with. If SARM1 acts as this sensor for misplaced or damaged DNA, not just in chemo, but potentially in other conditions, maybe even playing a role in nerve decline during aging, what could this discovery unlock for future therapies aimed at preserving overall nerve health and function? It's a really intriguing question.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe to your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.